The material provided today is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered legal or financial advice. Consult with a financial professional for your own needs. John E. Sestina & Company disclaims any and all liability for the interpretation and use of the content provided today.
I need help getting out of my student loan debt.
I'm so worried. How am I going to afford taking care of my parents?
When's a good time to get into the market?
I'm really not sure when I should start taking my Social Security.
I wonder if I have enough insurance.
I wonder when I can retire.
It's time to talk about your money, managing to be wealthy. Our team of fee-only financial planners is ready to help you create better financial habits, envision your long-term goals, and understand money management better than ever. Our resident hosts of John E. Sestina & Company are on deck to show you the way.
Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Tracy Bennett. Joining us today in the studio are certified financial planners, Spencer Hager and Cameron Utley. How you doing?
Fantastic.
Cameron, it's so nice to have you here. This is Cameron's debut on the podcast, so we're going to be kind, but I'm excited that you're here.
Well, my hands are shaking a little under the table, but we'll do just okay when we jump in here.
It's going to be okay. You know your stuff. That's what it matters. That's what matters. So, and believe me, I faux pas every week, so I'm certain people are on the other side of the audio going, oh, Lord, what is she going to say today? So you're doing fine already. Today we're talking about comprehensive financial planning for major life events, and this can be a crazy 2-hour conversation. Actually, probably more. We could probably break this up quite a bit, but we're just going to break down a few that people, you know, might have on their radar, kind of starting from the bottom. And I'm going to throw some bullet points at you, and you guys just kind of,
cool,
you know, riff. So we're going to start with financial planning for marriage. This is a really important one, whether you're starting with your first marriage or you are, you know, a blended family. There's a lot of considerations, I would assume. So as you're talking to our clients who are experiencing this and they're combining their finances, I guess let's first talk about the importance of, you know, open communication. So what are some of the things that are on the radar when someone comes to you and says that we're getting ready to get married? I guess let's start with the first scenario, first marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I always start with kind of what you touched on, the combining finances, because that's a little bit different for everyone. Like, I feel like I always had this image in my head that once you get married, everything's joint, everything's coming together, right? Everyone's on the same page. But more and more, you know, realize some people don't want that, right? It's just one joint bank account, several other individual accounts. That way you keep the spending separate. So that's probably the first part. I mean, open communications, hopefully a prerequisite. Hopefully you both have a pretty good feel at least for each other's financial situation going into the marriage, like I said, I would hope. And then from there, it's just trying to find out how much intermingling you want to move ahead with. That's my first thing.
Is there kind of a methodology that works overarching, or is it really up to the couple? Because, I mean, I know some people who have all of their finances combined, and I know of people who separate every single expense. So is that a conversation that you often have to have with people?
Yeah, I was going to say, to me, it's just pure personal preference. Like me, I just wanted the easiest route, and so everything's joint, me and my wife, and that's easy. I like it that way. I know plenty of other people that like to keep a lot of things separate. So I don't think you're doing anything wrong by doing one way or the other.
What about merging families? Does that change when you are on second marriage and, you know, maybe additional children in the picture? Is that a conversation or recommendation that you? Not a recommendation, but is that sort of a conversation that you have with people? I guess the better question is, do they come in oblivious to what a big problem this can be if it's not taken care of, you know, and you're not discussing it and everybody's on the same table?
I think what Spencer said earlier, I think that's when the communication side of it gets even more important. You hopefully at that point know maybe some of the dynamic and intricacies of maybe what each spouse is bringing in from a previous marriage, whether that's kids or, you know, other expenses or other lifestyle expectations. That's just the importance of being open and communicative. And to piggyback on what Spencer said earlier, it's deeply personal, deeply unique. So there really isn't one right way to do it.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, but you make a good point, though, on the secondary marriage. I despise when we always have to say talk to an attorney, but I'll say it when it comes to that, because if you have two different sets of estate plan documents and right, you just name a joint account, but then you have to be very meticulous with the beneficiary listings, because if you want to make sure that certain assets go to children from a previous marriage or something to that effect, you have to make sure you follow through.
So it sounds like you should do a scrub.
For sure.
Whether it's first marriage or second marriage, do an individual scrub to see what kind of accounts you have, what you use them for, where the beneficiaries are aligned. Make sure, my gosh, I've seen it happen personally in my situation where the beneficiaries were not aligned properly, and it was actually aligned to an ex-spouse, mm-hmm. and it just made things chaotic and crazy legally. So, especially when she passed away, and we were trying to get the account, taken care of properly. So, mm-hmm. Is that something that people I think you handle your checking and savings account beneficiaries a little differently than you would a retirement account, right?
Yeah, usually you just don't have as much flexibility with the bank accounts, like with a retirement account or life insurance policy. You can put 10 different beneficiaries on there with corresponding percentages. In my experience with bank accounts, you can do that to some extent, but some are less flexible than others, so you may not get to list that many beneficiaries or things like that.
At the same time, I think of life insurance as an easy one to think of this way. Some people may have different goals with what they want their beneficiaries to have. You know, if it's a second marriage or a blended family, maybe the spouses each want the kids to be the beneficiary of the accounts. As we may talk about with a lot of our clients, whether or not we want that or the client wants that or not, it's still a joint financial plan with mm-hmm. joint goals. Mm-hmm. And so we have to think about, do we need to go seek out additional insurance or have different documents, like you said, maybe a trust or something set up mm-hmm. to where we can have that best of both worlds where we're taking care of everyone.
Mm-hmm. And I think with checking and savings, you can just go to the bank and have a TOD signed by, to whomever you want it to go to, as opposed to a retirement account. You have to have beneficiaries set up,
typically.
Right? Yeah. Okay, let's go down to debt management. The approaches for dealing with pre-existing debts, this can be a real source of contention in the most healthy of relationships.
Yeah.
And probably, I would imagine, and I don't know this for sure, but I've heard that it's one of the money is one of the biggest causes of divorce. So before you go down the aisle and exchange nuptials, look at your individual debt. Make sure that everybody's okay with it.
Ask them for a balance sheet in advance. Yeah.
So well, mine is yours at that point.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how does that work when someone comes to you and you've got two individuals that want to get married and maybe one has an excessive amount of debt? Is there a conversation that you have specific to that scenario or what's the approach?
Yeah, I mean,
look at me like a potential client.
No, I mean, again, I feel like I keep going back to personal preference. Like I've worked with people where they want to keep the debt separate and, they manage their budget separately. They manage a lot of their bank accounts separately and they're going to pay their debt separately. And the other one is not going to be a part of repaying that debt. If that's the conversation, it's just everything's separated off, right? Make the budget, evaluate your own positive cash flow. And then to Cameron's point about the goals, based on that, once the joint goals have been addressed, what do you do with the individual? Others, it's, what's mine is yours. We're going after it. And then it's more of a joint conversation. That's how I approach it. I remember we did a radio show once and Steven was on with me. And I was engaged at the time. And I was like, I'm already starting to pay extra on my wife's student loans. She's like, don't do it until you've signed on the dotted line. He was opposed to it. So I would just say, get on the same page with the goals. You probably have to start a joint budget, right? Evaluate that. Probably have to set a couple other things ahead of the debt repayment, like starting to save towards retirement if you're not already, things like that. And then just decide, are you both going to do it together, separate? And that, either way is fine, but that drives everything.
And you got to talk through things like if one spouse experiences a job loss and you handle, person handles their budget separately, well, that might be all good, but at the end of the day, the bills still need paid, the food still needs put on the table, and that might change maybe the line of thinking.
Your credit's tied to each other. So if one individual has poor spending habits and you're getting ready to get married, you might want to have a conversation, look at that person's debt. It can be indicative of a characteristic, right, that you – a problem in the marriage later if you don't get a hold of it. Because it does become your problem legally. If you're legally attached to those accounts, your credit is attached to that.
Yeah, and that's where – to your point, you can get into the weeds a little bit. Like when you're talking about life insurance, right? Think about student loans. If you have a six-figure debt, but you took it out when you weren't married to your spouse, then, in theory, that may not go back on the other spouse. when it comes to insurance, the debt may just be forgiven.
Good point.
So you do have to think about it from that standpoint, too.
Yeah. So have the conversations, I think, is the moral of the story. Insurance planning, and we kind of tapped into that. And I've got a couple of points as we get into the conversation. This kind of comes up a lot. But as you're meshing your insurance needs, is there sort of a template? Do you have to reevaluate that, or can you kind of each come into the relationship with what you have and stick?
I think you should probably keep jumping in first here, but I think you need to reevaluate it. Do you need to get insurance right away? Maybe not. I know plenty of people where you don't have kids, you don't have any debt.
And I think we're talking about life insurance specifically. Is that what you mean?
I guess you should do both. Yeah, so life insurance, that's what I was thinking of there. So some people don't need it, but you should definitely evaluate health insurance, like especially if you're two W-2 employees. Mm-hmm. You should definitely deep dive both your open enrollment benefits, see which one's better, cross-compare.
And that's annually, right?
It is, but then when you get married, that's a qualifying life event. So you could presumably reevaluate and reimplement for both of you right then and there.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That and having a kid are usually the ones. Okay. Or divorce.
And then life insurance. A lot of people don't have estate planning, and I don't want to get too deep into this conversation. We're kind of just touching some of the soft points. But life insurance is – some people have no clue what that even means, if they need it. Some people – think it's legacy. Some people think it's for paying bills. What's your conversation with clients when they come in and getting ready to marry, and one has life insurance and one doesn't?
There's a whole host of reasons people get life insurance. I think the way a lot of us approach it, I don't know who in the office maybe come up with this or if we came up with it somewhere else, but you know, life insurance is, you know, insuring what we've yet to save for, and so coming into a new relationship, new marriage, maybe a blended family, like we talked about earlier, there are going to be different goals, no doubt. There's going to be changes that come about, and we need to it's important to reassess, if the worst were to happen, what do we want the next day, the next week, the next year to look like? Mm-hmm. And how do we see the family being taken care of? Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the first thing I would evaluate. When assessing how much life insurance, or do we need to change the amount of life insurance we need to have?
What are the other reasons people get life insurance besides that?
I mean, I think you pretty much hit it. I think it's, you know, stage of life. You know, at the beginning, it's just, you know, covering expenses for, you know, the spouse or kids you're going to presumably leave behind, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. That being said, we don't sell insurance. I don't try to up-talk people too much.
Oh, look at you getting ahead of the game.
Maybe we won't. No, I'm joking.
Got those disclaimers. I like it.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, that's probably the main one up front. And then I think a legacy more when you're, you know, in your 40s, 50s, getting closer to retirement. You, in theory, at least what we usually say, you don't need as much insurance at that point. But some people really like to have that nest egg. Mm-hmm. Some, if you're really up there in your net worth and your gross estate, you know, you could pass and have some estate taxes owed. A lot of that depends on what state you're in, because there's federal and state. Some people keep life insurance to cover the tax bill when they're dead.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. But that's probably more on the niche for people.
Yeah.
You got to have a pretty high estate to hit that.
Yeah. Is there like a number?
Like federal, it's $13 million per person. So if you, you know, two spouses passing, $26 million. The state matters. Like in Massachusetts, it's only $1 million. So anything above $1 million. And life insurance goes into that.
That's like a radical difference from one state to the next.
Yeah, East Coast is pretty big on it. East and West Coast, but yeah, like Ohio doesn't. Most of the Midwest, I want to say over 30 states don't have it. It's smaller these days.
Wow. It's interesting. All right. We kind of put the cart before the horse. Like, I should have brought this up first, but let's talk about prenups. I keep saying let's talk about. I'm back to my old habits. Prenuptial agreements. That's a touchy subject, I think, with some.
Super comfortable.
No, yeah, right. I don't know. I mean, I hear a lot about you guys talking to people about it, and you see it in movies and so forth. It would not be an easy conversation to have, for sure. So explain to people what a prenup is, what the scenario is that you might want to consider having one, why would you need it in the first place?
A prenuptial agreement is essentially just outlining going into the marriage, you know, what's on the table and what's off the table in the event that you get divorced, right? It's pretty much getting ahead of the curve and trying to divide up assets before you get married. Yeah, not super comfortable. I'm picturing like Craig or someone being in here, and he's like, it's always relevant. You always have to talk about it, yeah. Which is fair. But I would say, like, to me, most times it is when you either you're coming to the table with a lot of assets to begin with, right? Maybe you have an interest in a business that you need to make sure that's off the table in the event of a divorce. That you have to be pretty on top of it. If you have previous marriages, like we kind of talked about earlier, you have other people you're trying to set that money aside for, you, it's important to put in place. Again, I don't tell anyone you need to do it, but those are usually things where my ears prick up a little bit. But
yeah. I automatically associate a prenup with someone who has amassed massive wealth. But is there a medium point or a lower point even, or is it literally up to the circumstances?
I've seen it in scenarios where, again, not to go back to the blended family approach, but one spouse or both spouse might be maybe protective of their assets because they want to give the benefit to the kids. They mm-hmm. don't want their children to lose out on, you know, their savings to that point just because of a divorce.
So it's a way of protecting the kids, I guess, an insurance policy that protects them, yeah. their legacy.
Yeah, I mean, your point about the minimum, like you're going to rack up some attorney fees doing that. So there is, in theory, a minimum. But, I guess, again, it goes down to the conversation to begin with. You know, do we feel like we need to put that in place? Do we feel like their interests currently are coming up in the near future? We should put it in paper now and kind of go from there. You can also do post-nuptials, too. That varies by state. But you can always put an agreement into place after you're married.
What does that mean? Never heard of that before.
Prenup is pre-marriage, right? Post-nup is post-marriage. So you just put it into place. It's the same concept, right? You're essentially putting on the table assets that are not to be, you know, merged
in a divorce.
If you're divorced, yeah.
Oh, gotcha. I didn't know that. That's why don't more people do that?
Well, I mean, it's probably what we started with. It's not very comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, like a post-nup would be less offensive than signing a prenup, wouldn't it?
Probably. I mean, part of it too.
Like a contingency. If we don't make it, then we're signing documents that says what we brought into the marriage goes back to the respective family. That's a lot less awkward than saying you can't have what I have.
Yeah.
And I'm not marrying you until you sign this document.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And I'm not an expert on this too, but I want to say the longer you're married, the less relevant the prenup becomes. I want to say like if you're a year or two.
Yeah, we're not attorneys or anything.
Exactly. But, yeah. Thank you for putting that in there. That was great. But yeah, I think the longer it goes, the less relevant it becomes too. So I don't know.
Okay. Interesting. Budgeting, we don't like that word. I know that's a dirty word around here, but
Cameron likes it.
for immediate costs. So estimating and planning for medical expenses, baby supplies. So now we're kind of talking about planning for and preparing for parenthood, I guess, mm-hmm. specifically. You get to that next stage, and boy, that's a shocker. The cost of diapers, you guys don't know yet, but prepare yourself.
It's I've heard good things.
Yeah. It's insane. I think I read somewhere where the average baby goes through 700 diapers a year from birth to, is that right, Michael? Yeah. That's a lot of money because they ain't cheap. So estimating as you're planning on having children right away, right outside of your marriage. So you're not just planning for the wedding and you're not planning for the vacations and the house, but now you better be incorporating some cost into the plan for parenthood, right? So what kind of conversations do you have with clients who are looking to do that?
Find a friend with a kid.
So you get the hand-me-downs.
Yep. Well, that, and then you can just kind of live firsthand and see what they're going through. And
that's called birth control, isn't it?
No, but I think again, it comes back to maybe the word of the day with transparency, open communication, just kind of outlining what the family goals are, and being realistic with where you are at as a family, and every financial decision has a trade off to it, right? So maybe we can't. If we want to start a family, maybe we can't do this or do that, but maybe we can blend another goal into.
Yeah, that's a very slippery slope. You know, you can't tell people they can't do something. that's that primal need for immediate gratification.
Yep.
Is that hard to ring home when you have those conversations with people?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is the sacrifice and commitment, putting it, what do we call it, suffocating logic?
Yeah.
You start showing them numbers.
Yeah, I really do despise budgets, but Yeah, I think to Cameron's point, I think it's just everyone has to start it, right? I mean, maybe you don't have to implement a budget, but you definitely need to know what you're spending to begin with, or you should before you start doing something. Having a kid, I wouldn't say that, but like buying a house and things like that, you should probably have a baseline before you're trying to evaluate how much house you can afford. So, yeah, I mean, I'd just say get into a routine with it. It's not something necessarily that both spouses have to do. I don't know if that's a blasphemy, but like one spouse tracks it, keep the other one in the loop, right? And like, I'll keep throwing.
Hey, I'm throwing $10 into the baby fund.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. Or we spent $6,000 last month and just, you know, keep a running list. And then some people, that's a problem. Some people, it's... Yeah. We don't spend like crazy and we don't really need a budget, but you need to know what you spend.
So you need different pots for different purpose.
I mean.
Or you have to be very disciplined with the couple of pots that you have as you're navigating. Because parenthood, we're looking at maybe setting up college planning. How soon do you set up a college fund for a baby that doesn't exist? Newly married, right?
Is that a question?
Yeah.
Rhetorical?
Yeah.
I think we touched on before. I usually wait until the baby's in the picture unless the due date is at the end of the year, because then there's some
tax. We did a show about this, I know.
That's what I was saying, yeah. Yeah. And then Craig immediately came and was like, oh, I did it before. So, you know, if you want to be an overachiever, that's fantastic. But, yeah, I think, you know, sometime in the vicinity of the due date. And then there could be some tax reasons why you do it before, but most people don't get too worried about
that. Is the 529 the way to go?
9 times out of 10. I still need to do a podcast showing the people the breakdown of the fees and the penalties. You still probably come out ahead with the 529.
So let's tell people what a 529 is actually, what kind of account it is. You want to tell people?
Yeah, so it's at a very basic level, it's a college savings plan. It's you can get non-state-based plans with some of the, you know, investment houses out there and any website. But most of them are offered by the 50 states, so wherever you live, you've got a 529 plan available to you. Every dollar you put in can be used for college in the future for the child. It can also be used for other expenses as far as like K-12 tuition, private school and college, trade school, books and supplies. Really, there's a laundry list of things that you can use a 529 plan for. And the benefit is that money that you put in can grow tax-free and come out tax-free as long as you use it for those qualified expenses. So a lot more powerful than maybe just writing a check out of the bank account.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, well said. I'm going back to the budget. I feel like I'm thinking back to earlier.
No.
I will say with this, my personal bias is I think it's a lot easier the more you commingle. Because I think to Cameron's point, like, it is fair to say, like, well, we can do some of the separate. But, you know, if the rubber hits the road and someone gets disabled or someone loses a job, it's all in the same pot at the end of the day.
Right.
So like eventually when we're talking about retirement, things like that, we need to know what the total number is between the two of you. So if you're doing a lot separate, it can become a beast to have two separate budgets, mm-hmm. you know, 7 different bank accounts and everything else. So, you know,
can't imagine.
Choose your own thing. But
can't imagine. Okay. Estate planning. What are the key steps in updating wills and setting up documents? Let's talk about the documents people need as they're building a family and starting their family. What do they need to think about? You know, baby's on the way. We've got our 529 set up.
Yeah, I mean,
what's next?
The main one that would apply for if you have a baby on the way, to me, it's pretty much just the will. I mean, they're all relevant, right? And we've done other shows talking about it. But mm-hmm. that's the one where, you know, if it's married having a kid, right, if you had one in place before, you probably had provisions in place where your estate was going to flow to other individuals. So make sure you get that updated for anything that slips through the cracks, goes through to your new spouse if you want that. Same deal with kids. If kids are coming into the picture, that should be in there as well. And then the guardianship provision, which is just something happens to you, something happens to both of you. You know, who's gonna take care of your children?
Who's gonna parent up?
Not to plug the attorney, but to plug the attorney, especially when it's maybe a second marriage or I guess even a new marriage. You know, an attorney is very good at knowing the intricacies and the uniqueness of every family situation. If it's a new marriage and you know, an attorney can help you know the ins and outs of maybe the divorce decree that might have some rules that may dictate what you put in your estate plan. If you have to list your ex-spouse as the first guardian in that case. So maybe just a shout out to our attorney on that front.
Yeah, definitely. Seek the professional. Don't try to do it by yourself. Okay, moving to the next point, managing divorce financially. We've had a blissful marriage. We've had a couple of kids.
Quick
we have a house.
Right,
we've got the 529. It ain't working out. So the next step is to say, all right, it's time to divide the assets. Is there a strategy for equitable division of marital property? How do you even begin to tackle that?
That's the first thing I always see with divorces. Its main focus is equity. No, that was sarcasm heavy. I was just going to say, no, I mean, I don't really know an effective way to do it, unfortunately. It all comes down to just how amicable it is. You know, are attorneys involved?
Pure emotion.
Is a mediator involved? Is this just a pure dissolution and you're kind of deciding the terms on your own? And again, I would never jump into that pool and say, here's the best way you should go about dividing your assets, because that's just a volatile topic.
So two relevant points I think you guys have already gone into is the legal and financial part of it. Seek the professional. Don't try to do it on your own. Why is that so important in this situation?
Well, I know I'm not even saying that either, because when you say seek the professional, that to me means go bring in attorneys and the fees go up there. So, I mean, I definitely know some divorces where it was very amicable. Pretty much the attorney was only involved to finalize the deal because they were able to come to their own agreement as to how they wanted to divide it. If you can't do that on your own, then, yeah, you know, other individuals are getting involved and we're off to the races. It is what it is. I don't know a way to avoid that one.
I'm very jaded and you're really cute, because I don't see that as a real – most people can't get along at that stage. It's
yeah, and I
it's,
agree.
In all perfect worlds, it's wonderful, but – Yeah.
I feel like I acknowledge that it's usually really bad.
Right. So they have to revise their wills and trusts, and all those documents we just talked about have to be updated in reverse, right?
I mean, yeah, I typically see that. I don't know what you've seen, Cameron. Typically, that's post-divorce, but you, in theory, could start to rework that in the midst of it. That's just a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah, you probably want to do that as soon as possible after everything's final, the dust settles a little bit, just because, you know, with the lingering life insurance or the beneficiary on the retirement account. You don't want that, you know, the worst to happen and go, oh man, something happened to me and it didn't go to the person I wanted it to.
Right.
All right. Again, the follow through with that too, right? People have to remember, you can update your will, but if you don't update your life insurance or some of those other things that have the previous spouse as a beneficiary, there's really not that much you can do. So you have to remember
that's a great point. A lot of people think that the will is the end all be all, but you really have to drill down to the different accounts, right?
Really, any document that has a beneficiary listed is going to supersede the will.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So follow through.
Okay, transitioning, planning for career transitions. There's lots of things we could talk about, but let's just hit the high point. So when you're changing jobs, what would be, I guess, the top three things for a person who's decided to leave their employer and maybe start a business, what would be the top three things that they should consider financially?
Benefits, right? What are you giving up? You know, what were the benefits of your old job and what's available at the next job? Type of compensation. I know you said if you're going to start a business, but if you're just going W-2 to W-2, I think we did a show on this last week, right? If you're going from a job that's pure salary to a job that's, you know, salary plus bonus plus stock awards, right? That's a big one. And then just tax withholdings. If you're a business owner, that's a whole different show. Right? If you're going from W-2 to business owner, there's a lot with that, but those are my top three.
Yeah, we could spend a lot of time talking about that.
On that type of compensation, hopefully when we're talking about career transitioning, hopefully we're knowing that the job we're going to is going to take care of the family, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some occupations where, you know, maybe it's a passion change because maybe you feel, you know, it's time to leave what you're doing to find something new. It may come with a bit of a pay cut at first or permanently, who knows. But as long as you got to make sure when you're doing that, you're making the smart move by, you know, making that transition and being able to still put food on the table.
And that starts with living expenses, right?
Yeah, there you go.
The two words that we talk about constantly is, you know, living expenses.
That's a great – no, it's a great point, though. I mean, that's what I was trying to say earlier. Yeah. It's really boring and sounds corny every time we bring it up, but any big financial decision you want to make, unless you're just trying to wing it, you really need to know the number, and that's a huge one.
Yeah, and that's actually a good segue to my next question. So retirement plan management, how do job changes impact retirement plans? Like if you've got a 401k that's existing, what do you do with it when you go to your next employer? Do you just leave it lie, or do you roll it over? I mean,
well, it first starts with,
is there a great solution?
I think it first starts with what's available at the new job. You know, a lot of if you work for, you know, maybe a nonprofit or a government agency, they might have different retirement plans than for-profit companies. You can't necessarily always, you know, move from one account to another. If it's, you know, a 401k to a 401k, that's easy. but you may not, you're not able to move from a 401k plan with your old job to if your new job has a 457. Those aren't necessarily as compatible. So maybe Spencer's, I'm guessing, comment coming up. If you're moving from one plan to the next, you want to start with what are the investment options available? What are the maybe contribution types? And then what are the fees for the new account versus the old one?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we don't want to get a new job and realize that our 401k plan is twice as expensive as the one we just left from. We're still going to use the new plan, most likely, but maybe we don't move a big chunk of our money over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only other thing I'll add to some plans, it's becoming less common, but they have a vesting schedule. So like if your old 401k had an employer match, some will say, okay, second the money goes in, you're 100% vested. So if you leave us in a year, all that money's yours. Others will put like a 5-year vesting in where it's a 20% every year. Again, not saying that should dictate you leaving, but if you're kind of on the fence, it's good to know. It can kind of be like a golden handcuff to some extent where you know you're losing out on 40% of the match that they put in that plan, and there's really no way to work around that other than to stay with the employer and wait it out.
Boy, you really have to be present, don't you? Really have to be paying attention.
Yeah.
Health and other benefits. What factors do people need to consider when they're evaluating and selecting new health insurance plans? And again, this is a whole show, maybe 10 shows, depending on which facet of health insurance we're talking about. And we did a full show on health insurance. But what do you talk to people about when they're going in a different direction and the health benefits are now, you know, right in their face? They need to transition to a different policy.
There's a gap between your old employer and new one. It could be expensive. And then, I mean, outside of just, you know, comparing between the plans, seeing what's available, right, what's the deductible, out-of-pocket maximum, the premium, and then just, you know, be mindful going in because some people, you know, have a really good health insurance plan, go to another employer where it's not so good. I mean, it could quantify to several $1,000 per year in extra costs, which, again, the transition may still be worth it, but we're talking about a $10,000 raise for kind of a lateral move. You know, it's important to know if you're having some of that raise eaten away just by, you know, lesser benefits. So just compare it all.
No two health plans are made the same. So definitely read through the plan, ask questions, whether that's to your HR or to your financial planner, to your insurance, you know, advisor, if you're going the private health insurance route. Just know what you're signing up for because there's different out-of-pocket expenses, different premium breakdowns, and you just don't want to be sitting at the doctor's office and be told that you're going to have a nice little $500 or $800 bill to pay when you thought you were walking in maybe for $50 or $75.
Right. Blind faith, we call it. Don't have the blind faith. Read the fine print. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Okay, finally, caring for aging parents. This is, again, a big topic. And with the boomers now entering into that stage, there's a lot of folks out there that could use some good information about, you know, elder care. Evaluating care options. Is there... When people are assessing costs of benefits of in-home care versus assisted living and nursing home, where do you tell people to start?
It's tough. If it's a pre, like the elder parents need support, the further ahead you can get on it, the better, just knowing to what extent, like what are their financials. Not a lot of parents do that. I understand, you know, keep it close to the vest. So
it's a hard conversation.
Probably just finding out, you know, if you're at the point where they need the care, you need to know their finances if you're helping out. And then if they have, depending on their background, like if you were in the military, you could have benefits with the VA. Medicare will pick up some of it. Like it changes every year. But if you're getting in-home care, there could be some things that Medicare picks up. You don't have to pay out of pocket for it. And then from there, you pretty much just have to start looking at other services. You know, if it's full-blown nursing home care, there are plenty of nursing home facilities. Reach out to them, do tours, find out what their cost is. Each one's going to be different. If you think you're going to try and do it at home, try and reach out to different nursing care facilities that people will come in.
People forget about the veterans benefits. People forget about that. Yeah. That's a big one. And you can't get veterans benefits and Medicaid at the same time, so do your research on that.
What's the name? There are different ones too. There are different services. I'm blanking on some of their names where all they do is help with trying to find different facilities and resources.
Oh, like almost a brokerage,
costs,
right?
To some extent, interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I'm less familiar with the cost involved, but I remember one. They, you know, reached out to 5-6 different nursing homes. They had a call, found out kind of what you were looking for, what you wanted to prioritize. I don't know how much they followed through. Like I said, you still have to go through, do the tour, look at the finances, but they at least helped get the ball rolling.
That's major. When I went through it, I mean, you spend a lot of time. I think I looked at 12, 13 different facilities. Yeah. And the one resource that I didn't know was available until sort of midway through the process is that all nursing homes are rated by the state. So you can determine if they have, you know, red marks against them and for what before you pull the trigger, you know, to sign on the dotted line. So there are resources out there. Do your research. I didn't know about the brokerage type of services. That's pretty cool. The implications of transferring assets to aging parents, what does that look like? Is there a tip that you can give people as they're progressing to that stage to protect that?
Yeah, I can hit that. So you said transferring to aging parents. Usually it's, I think, of transferring from aging parents.
You're talking about, like, paying for care?
Well, I would imagine for paying for care.
Oh,
right?
I see what you mean. I thought you were saying it. Again, I was going towards the Medicaid route if you want to try and...
So financial support strategies, I guess, is what this falls under. So families that are planning to financially support elders.
Yeah, I mean, talk to your CPA and see if you can get any sort of tax benefit. Again, that's not trying to jump to that, but depending on how much support you're giving, how much of their lifestyle you're funding, you could get some tax write-offs for that. Potentially, that's usually the first one. And then technically you have to be a little bit mindful of gifting because technically you're, you know, gifting funds to cover it. Even then, most people are not going to run into paying gift taxes. You may have to file some forms. But again, that just depends on how much care. If we're talking $10,000, not really too much. If we're talking $50,000 per year, $100,000 per year, that's a different scenario.
Yeah.
Getting into retirement planning, and this is kind of the last stage, you know, before we kind of start relaxing and not worrying about all this again. And we could go on and on, but the longevity risk management is a big one, you know, as you get to be 40, 50, headed towards retirement. What strategies can ensure that retirement savings last through retirement, you know, that they're protected and you have what you need? Is there any one thing that comes to mind?
I think we're all thinking the same word right now.
Track living expenses, yeah.
I was going to say, I think it's two.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it just comes down to knowing what you need, right?
And how much is enough?
Hopefully you're not leaving the workforce before you know you have enough. And that's what we talk about and preach around here is what is enough. It's different for everyone. So just making sure we come up with that, you know, number or come up with that level of lifestyle that we foresee ourselves having. And then as things happen, as we get older, you know, it's not, you know, health expenses don't usually add on top of it, but it usually replaces things. Maybe travel, maybe, you know, extra trips to the grocery store. Maybe we're prioritizing healthcare at that point.
Mm-hmm. And would those be considered unexpected life events?
I think it's pretty certain that we're going to have some health issues along the way, and you're going to need that level of care at some point.
All right.
Yeah, I think, and if you can do a trial run, which to me always sounded unrealistic, but I feel like more and more it's realistic, especially with how much there's the working remotely where, you know, if you think you want to go, if you're in Ohio, you think you want to go to Florida or something else, or you want to go to the Carolinas, if you can, you know, go spend a couple months and work down there just
I'm
to see.
I'm sitting there thinking, trial run, what are you going to see, figure out what you were saying.
To see how that impacts your lifestyle number, because again, like if you're going from Ohio to Massachusetts, you're probably going to see a cost of living uptick. And so the best you can to, you know, be there, see what that expense is going to look like when you're in that spot, that's helpful too. But instead, I think of it more from when you're moving states in retirement.
Yeah, that's actually good advice. Yeah. Take off the rose-colored glasses. So that we hope that you have learned a lot from this conversation. I think that there's a common vein of seek the professional. You know, you guys know what you're talking about. This is such a universe, what we do here. And if you think you have your ducks in a row, there might be one duck that's getting ready to cross the road. You need to grab them and put them back in line. Get the professional to help you. So your attorneys, your CPAs, and your certified financial planners. We hope this conversation has given you some great food for thought as you navigate your own plan. And we're glad you tuned in. We hope you'll come back. We are Managing to Be Wealthy.
That's a wrap for today's episode of the Managing to Be Wealthy podcast. We help you make the most of your money without any hidden fees or commissions. Remember, the best investment you can make is in yourself and your financial future. Keep listening for more expert advice and tips. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. to schedule a 1-hour complimentary consultation to discuss your financial concerns, visit our website, managingtobewealthy.com.